It's time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for June 12th, 2021. This week, we jump across the pond, as they say, to speak with David Bradford. David is the fitness editor for Cycling Weekly. And his article, titled, Why is the Peloton Hiding Its True Colors?, is getting a lot of attention. In fact, it caught mine. What David and apparently a whole lot of other people want to know is why there are no gay riders in the pro peloton. Or are there? They aren't coming forward, and even after this article was published, the response from male riders has been crickets. Statistically, it's beyond improbable that there are no gay men out of 968 riders in the pro peloton. So what's going on here? Well, we'll find out in a moment. After our mid-show break, we'll meet up once again with journalist, teacher, and urban planning researcher John Sirico. When we last spoke back in April, we talked about what life was going to be like post-pandemic and how cities have and will continue to respond. Now his new piece for Bloomberg City Lab focuses on the possibility of a $10 billion, yes, that's billion with a B, for greenways, from big projects like the East Coast Greenway to your neighborhood connector to a local path. Biking and walking are slowly making their way to center stage in legislation, large and small, all over the country. John will be with me in the second half of the show. David Bradford spent a lot of time trying to find someone to speak to him about the topic of gay riders in the pro peloton. Out of 968 competitors, the statistical probability that not one of these riders is gay is about one in a trillion. David called his mathematics buddy to establish the real probabilities. I wanted to know more, and I also wondered whether women are more likely to just come out and tell it like it is. And we find out that they are. Here's my conversation with David. Hello, David. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest today. How are you?
Hi, Diane. Yes, I'm very well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it is my pleasure. My pleasure. I love talking to people from over the pond, as they say.
Likewise.
Where are you in England?
I'm down near the south coast, a little place called Lewes, L-E-W-E-S. Very old, small market town, near Brighton.
So that isn't necessarily where the publication is headquartered, though, right? Are you working from home? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All of us are working from home now. The publication is actually where it was based in Farnborough and is soon moving just up the road to Reading. So, yeah, it's quite a long way from me, actually. But was going into the office occasionally, sort of once a week, until obviously everything was turned upside down.
Right. So I have a question about your publication, Cycling Weekly. The masthead says that it's been established in 1891. Did I read that right? or did you guys make that shit up?
it's not a misprint. Don't worry. It's actually true. Yeah. Amazingly enough, this is our 130th anniversary year, which we've been celebrating with special issues and retro kit that we've launched and so on. But 1891 was when the mag was founded.
Wow. Nothing lasts that long. Actually, England lasts that long. No, that's really, really cool. I think that's really cool. So give me just a little bit of history of the publication.
Yeah, I'm not an expert, but a colleague of mine, Simon Smythe, actually wrote a piece quite recently about the formation. And it was a guy called Edmund Dangerfield and a group, I think there were four or five of them that Simon in his piece described as a group of angry young men. He was a publisher, but they were annoyed, I think, that there was nothing around All the cycling media of the time was only interested in ordinary bicycles, the penny farthings. And obviously the safety bicycle had come along just 6 years earlier. So cycling as we know it, I guess, with bikes as we know them, was pretty new then. And they decided that they wanted a magazine to talk about safety, you know, the latest technology as it was then. And so that's what they did. They set up and went their own way. And it was, you know, when I guess cycling as we know it was born pretty much. And they were club members of cycling clubs. I think Dangerfield was a member of Bath CC, and he ended up winning the Bath Road 100 at the time in 6 hours 38 minutes. So, I mean, that sounds pretty impressive to me, given what their technology must have been like back then. But yeah.
And the roads. Who knows what the roads were like?
And then. The roads. Yeah. Right. I mean, who knows? But yeah, it's an amazing history, and obviously, having an archive of that length is quite a major asset for us.
Right.
And we do lots of articles looking back at the history of the magazine, which is always fascinating.
So do you still produce a printed magazine?
We do, yeah. Okay. Every week, a printed magazine. Yeah, we do. We're holding on in there despite the decline of print. It's obviously affecting us as much as anyone. But
no, I like print. I still read books.
Same.
You know, when publishers send me a message saying, hey, there's a new book, do you want to review it? I'm like, and they say, do you want a PDF or do you want the book? I'm like, just send me the book. I spend enough time in front of a screen, right?
Same here. Well, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about David. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into journalism, and then we'll talk about the article that brought me to you.
Great. Yeah, sure. Well, I studied English at university. And then after that, I'd always been interested in writing and editing. I think that was sort of what I had decided I wanted to do, and ended up working in motorcycle journalism, first in the trade press and then in the consumer press, until I was diagnosed in 2004, I think, with an eyesight condition called retinitis pigmentosa, which means my retinas are deteriorating because of a genetic fault, which meant I lost my driving license at that point, which sort of took away the pleasures of motorcycling, really. So I made a change in direction at that point. And luckily, the company I was working for then owned cycling titles, as they still do now. So I was able to make a sideways step onto bikes, two-wheelers without engines. And that's what I did.
Wow, so interesting. So you were sort of forced into it, and now you like it.
I always rode bikes, always rode push bikes. I think after I lost my driving license, I got much more into fitness. I started to do quite a lot of running. It was, you know, as I sort of lost the ability to ride, to get my thrills, I guess, from riding fast motorbikes. It was sort of endurance exercise then became my main thing. So it was quite a neat sort of transition, really, that I never really had to look back. And I'm kind of quite grateful it happened in many ways. That might sound like a strange thing to say about being diagnosed with an eyesight condition, but it sort of in many ways has been a blessing, strangely enough.
Well, you look pretty fit.
Yeah. Well, but getting a bit past it now, Diane. But not yet.
Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with David Bradford. He is the fitness editor for Cycling Weekly. They are celebrating their 130th anniversary of publishing. I just think that's remarkable. So I guess we should talk about this article. And it struck me that at this moment in time, it's really a timely article. It's important. It's important we talk about it. It was from May 17th on Cycling Weekly. You'll be able to get a link to it on our blog site. Why is the Peloton hiding its true colors? And the first sentence says it all, really. It's of the 978 riders, which I also didn't know that number, in the men's pro Peloton, none are gay. That's just not even possible. And you are bringing that to the attention of all of us. So let's talk about what's really going on. What's going on in the Peloton that, you know, men who are peacocks, you know, walking around in bright, beautiful colors in Lycra and nobody's gay, that's not even possible, right?
Yeah, I mean, the figures are interesting to start with, aren't they? I mean, I didn't include continental teams in that figure. That is just Pro Tour, World Tour and Pro Tour. And to have, you know, it's almost 1,000 riders. To have no gay riders in all those riders is really just not feasible. I mean, I had to go to a friend who's got a maths degree from Cambridge to even work out the probability of that just being chance. And as I put in the piece, it comes out as 1 in 10 trillion chance, which is, I think, as good as impossible as we need to get, right? So there are bound to be plenty of riders who are not being open about their sexuality, and there are lots of reasons, complicated reasons for that, which. Yeah, in the piece I tried to get into, and I wanted to do that by speaking to people from, you know, inside elite cycling. You know, I don't have, as an amateur athlete, I don't really have access to what that environment is like. I didn't want to make assumptions. I wanted to, as much as possible, get onto the inside and try and find out from that inside perspective what the reasons might be for that, for riders not feeling at liberty to speak openly about, as I put it in the piece, I think, you know, who they really are. And yeah, lots of things came out of that. I guess the first one that struck me, I spoke to a rider we called Brian in the piece. He didn't want to be identified, who was pursuing a career as a pro rider, got to a good level, did some UCI races. And he spoke about this, just cycling being very kind of insular at that level, how, you know, you train with the same set of people day in, day out. There's not much talk about issues outside of cycling, and you feel a great pressure to conform was the thing that really came out from Ryan. At the same time, you know, thinking ahead, that those riders, young riders, that stage are very much focused, very much fixated on getting the contract. They don't want to stand out. It seems there's a fear that anything that sort of sets them apart, putting their head above the parapet, could jeopardize that. And it seemed like being different in terms of sexuality, the fear was there that could be enough to set them apart in a negative way. So that was the first thing that struck me.
You would think today, especially today, when we talk about diversity and equity and inclusion, that the peloton, and cycling's a hard sport, I understand that, but if you're at that level, your sexuality does not really matter if you can compete in the peloton. So are you getting any sense that there are any changes? The younger riders maybe are less likely to hide who they are, or do you think it's going to be a continuing problem? Anything with coaches or team managers or that kind of thing?
Well, I'd like to think so. I'd like to think it's going to get easier for younger riders. You know, we know that young people in wider society are certainly much more open to you know, diversity, to different forms of sexuality, different ways of living. We know that. You know, there's loads of evidence of that. Is that going to feed into cycling? I think so. I do think so. I hope so. And I interviewed Justin Leivens, a Belgian cyclocross rider, who came out in January this year. And that was very, very uplifting, because he said he has had no negative reaction whatsoever. You know, he's a youngster, 20-year-old rider, and has had only positive messages of support sort of flooded in. Doesn't seem to have, you know, he said he was worried when he did it. He's worried what the reaction was going to be, that he'd be hated, he'd get a backlash, but it just didn't happen. So I think that's, you know, that should give us some hope. And he spoke about how, you know, people of his age have been through a different kind of education. At school, they're taught about sexuality. They're just, their minds are shaped differently on these matters. So yeah, I think there is hope, but it seems, surprisingly, also to me, slow. You know, the amount that sport seems to be lagging behind wider society does seem slow. It does seem to be dragging somewhat.
Do you think that the fact that he was or is a cyclocross rider as opposed to a road competitor makes a difference? Do you think the branch of the sport might lend itself more to somebody who can just be who he is? He's just out there barreling through the gravel.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Possibly. I don't know. It's not something I did think about. Is this a continental thing? You know, is mainland Europe somehow a bit more liberal? Is it a bit easier compared to in the UK or the US? I don't know. I mean, I didn't really sort of find anything that strongly suggested that that would be the case. But perhaps there are regional differences. I'm not quite sure. Not something I ended up drawing much of a conclusion on, to be honest.
So we're going to take a real quick break and we'll be back to talk with David some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with David Bradford. He is the fitness editor. Is that correct? Of Cycling Weekly?
That's right.
Okay,
that's
fine.
Right.
There must be lots of editors, but fitness is where we are right now. We are talking about whether or not there are any gay riders in the pro peloton. And as David said earlier, the chances that there are not are one in a gazillion, trillion, bazillion. So there's not much chance of it. When we left off, we were talking about a young cyclocross rider, Belgian, and a male. But let's talk a little bit about the women's side. It seems that women are more open and more willing to talk about and show that they are gay and that they don't seem to have any backlash or much backlash. Is that true?
Yeah, this is something I kept hearing as I was preparing to write the piece. But I kept hearing this, you know, it's easier for gay women to be open about their sexuality. I didn't want to take for granted that that was true immediately, because I thought about pro riders in Britain. I couldn't immediately think of many examples of openly gay women riders. So I thought, well, I'm going to be cautious about this and actually speak to some, you know, find some to speak to. And Taylor Wiles was the World Tour rider I spoke to, and he was absolutely fascinating on the subject. But she did confirm, yes, it absolutely is much, much easier. She has she's been openly gay almost from the start of her professional career. And she said that on every team that she's ridden on, there's been at least one other gay rider on the team. So it's a complete world of difference for the women. Yeah, it's a stark, stark difference.
How interesting. So do you think, and this, of course, it's just an opinion, do you think women maybe are just more accepting of things? This is the way it is, and I'm just going to keep on going. Are men that concerned about homophobia and women are less concerned?
I think it's to do with what often gets called toxic masculinity. I really think that's at the root of it. I mean, Taylor was really insightful on this. And spoke because she's actually asked fellow rider, male riders in the pro peloton, why aren't there any openly gay male riders? And she said she was shocked because she sort of assumed that, you know, she was speaking to people who would, a young guy, she just assumed that they would have fairly progressive attitudes, and that's not what she heard. They said things like, well, you know, what about getting changed in front of the, you know, those riders on the team bus? You know, just kind of almost childish attitudes. And another one said, well, they wouldn't be strong enough to make it to the top. This is a tough sport, you know. And what Taylor said, which I thought was really, really interesting, she said, it proves that there's still this link being made between homosexuality and femininity, and that falsely equating to weakness. And she said, then this means that, you know, it's bound up with misogyny. It's all part of the same problem. This link being made, this false link between femininity and weakness and what it actually means to be a gay man. And I think that's so much at the root of the problem.
You know, I'm not young, but I have had gay male friends pretty much all my life. I have a cousin who is, you know, he, I mean, clearly, he was gay when he was a little boy. And it's just never mattered to me. And yet it seems to matter a lot to the other men I know. So I understand what you're saying. I guess I didn't understand where it was coming from 100%. The last thing I want to talk about, which you didn't really bring it up, and it's not maybe part of this particular article, but about the issue with trans riders. And of course, mm-hmm. we are experiencing some really big backlash here in this country with states passing some really draconian laws that are going to damage, I think, some of the young people in our country, which is really, really sad. And of course, then it threw up all of these red flags for events and all of that. Are there questions about trans riders that you think need to be asked and that will affect or influence the Peloton?
It's certainly an important issue. It certainly seems to be, unfortunately, a highly contentious issue. Just judging from some of the less pleasant feedback that I got to the piece relating to Emily Bridges' inclusion, and I just think that we've got to focus on the individuals. We've got to focus on the human beings here, and basically listen to them, hear them. Because I think if we do that, we get a much more realistic perspective on what's actually going on, rather than leaping into a sort of rather concocted sort of culture wars that people seem to want to leap into before actually stopping and listening to what the reality is.
Well, it doesn't seem like it's going to abate very quickly, although I do see trans riders now stepping up. Molly Cameron is a perfect example, who came out with a brand new organization today called Ride, and it's LGBTQ, come and ride with us. And that, mm-hmm. that then begs the question of the competition. I mean, we're talking at the highest level, pro Peloton, cyclocross worlds, that kind of thing. But on a day-to-day basis, how important or how damaging could it be to just let people ride together?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very good question, because there's so much heat in this debate and not very much light. And part of that is looking at, okay, so what actually is the problem now? There's a concern about protecting women's sport. It's a legitimate concern. Of course we want to protect women's sport. Women have fought for the right. That's what I understand that, but we need to keep this in proportion and see what the reality actually is at the moment. Where are these trans riders, dominating women's sport, wrecking women's sport? It's just not happening, right?
Right.
So we need to, the whole thing needs to just be calmed down. We need to get to what the reality is at the moment. And the other aspect is the focus needs to be on, first of all, athlete health, protecting. If we're going to have policies, we need to look at this. Sport doesn't matter more over and above athlete health. We've got to look after the welfare of these people first and foremost. And after that, we've got to do as best we can for inclusion. That's my take anyway.
I think it's a good one, and I appreciate it. Do you have any other thoughts about the state of the sport? What are you following right now that will impact your work over the next few months? I know the Olympics are coming up. I don't know what's going to happen there. What kind of projects are you following up more on this particular topic?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully there'll be more to come on this. I mean, it's quite, being a weekly magazine, but it's quite fast paced. We're always on to the sort of the next
right.
thing, not that we don't get chance to dwell for long, but yeah, I mean, it would be great if I think, the next step forward would be if a high profile rider were to come out. I mean, I would never want to put any pressure on any individuals or anything like that, because it's obviously down to personal choice. But I think it could have a massively important influence if a male rider were to do that. And it would be very, very interesting to see what developed from that, because at the moment, the response to the piece, although it's been really pleasing, and there's been a great level of response, there has been a sort of conspicuous silence from male riders, I have to say. And also interestingly, from a US perspective, I had initially set out to work, sort of collaborate with a coach and rider called Brendan Hausler on this, who himself is gay, and he reached out to lots of contacts and was pretty much stonewalled, blanked. He didn't really get anything back, and it ended up meaning that sort of I went on my own with the piece from a UK European perspective, because Brendan really couldn't get anyone to speak. And I think that's sort of probably is quite revealing of the situation, unfortunately.
Well, let's hope that we have a little more openness going forward. I really appreciate you writing the piece. We've been speaking with David Bradford. He is the fitness editor at Cycling Weekly, celebrating their 130th year, which is still mind-boggling. If you'd like to read the article, it is titled, "Why is the Peloton Hiding Its True Colors?" Great graphic photo at the top of the piece. You can't see what we're doing, but when you see it, it's a guy in a helmet and with his face, and he's got his hands over his mouth. David, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. I hope we get to talk again. This has been a delightful conversation.
Likewise. Thanks very much, Diane.
All right. You have Enjoy a great day. All right.
You too. Cheers. Bye-bye.
David Bradford is the fitness editor for Cycling Weekly. I'm still stunned by the fact that the publication is 130 years old. If you want to read David's article, we've posted a link to it on our OutspokenCyclist.com site. David's article also made the cover of the print magazine, too. Let's take a break, and when we return, we'll head to Queens, New York to speak with John Sirico. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have Bike Law as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. Back on The Outspoken Cyclist, I'm Diane Jenks. On May 12th, the Red Line Greenway, a $6.6 million bike and pedestrian trail that is adjacent to our Cleveland Regional Transit Red Line, opened after a private ribbon-cutting ceremony. Although it is only 2 miles long, it instantly made what was once a dicey journey through an area of Cleveland a safe and pleasant connection to two of our rapid transit train stations. So from short connections like this to the massive project of the East Coast Greenway, the 3,000-mile pathway between Maine and Florida along the East Coast, there is a lot of momentum and interest in funding more infrastructure for biking and walking. I wanted to talk with John Sirico about his current piece for Bloomberg City Lab, Greenway Stimulus Could Bring Bike Boom in Biking and Walking Trails, and look at some of the details of all the possibilities. Hi, John. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Big news this week, and thank you for joining me again. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much, Diane. Great to be back.
Yeah, you're in Manhattan. No, are you in Manhattan?
I'm in Queens, just outside of Manhattan.
Yeah, well, it's not any cooler there either.
Definitely not.
Well, summer is here. So May 4th, you wrote just a killer article for Bloomberg City Lab titled Greenway Stimulus Could Bring Boom in Bike and Walking Trails. And we are talking enormous amounts of money in the bicycle world. And you lay out some of the possibilities for this kind of funding. So I just wanted to tell you that we had a little 2 mile greenway open that connects our little tiny train system. And we have something called the Rapid Transit. It runs, it doesn't run very far and very long, but it goes from the airport to downtown and to a few other places on the west side of town. And then we have the Blue Line, which of course is on the east side of town, whatever, blue, green, red, whatever. But they just opened up this connector. And it's just really cool. But the price tag looked really high to me until I saw what it really takes to do some of these things. So let's talk a little bit about the greenways and what it is this article brings out.
Sure. So the first kind of thing we were trying to figure out, as I'm sure you might have seen in the article, is that we're just trying to define what is a greenway. What exactly is it? Like, what qualifies, you know, what makes a greenway different than the bike lane down the block for me, you know, that kind of just a stripe on the street. And really what kind of advocates told me is that it's a multi-use trail. It's both park and transportation. But that always wasn't the definition of it. When the term greenway first kind of came up, it was during the urban park movement of the 1800s. So you had these kind of visionary thinkers like Frederick Law Olmsted, Calvert Vaux, who, you know, designed parks all over America, designed the urban parks that we know today. And they saw greenways as just kind of belts of green that would connect all of their parks. Not as much thinking about utility, which is, I think, a key part of greenways, that it has utility. You can use it to get from point A to point B. And really, we saw a change in the 1980s and 1990s, where our funding systems really changed in the U.S. to be able to kind of promote more systems that had both cycling, walking, multi-use, you know, has green. I think that's a really important part. Has green space along it, flowers, grass, whatever it might be. And it connects places. And I think the connective tissue is really, really key here.
That is a problem, that a lot of little paths have been built and they don't connect.
Yeah.
You know, so we've got one that goes from A to B, and then you have to get off the trail, figure out how to get to C, and then C to D. So what's going to happen with this kind of funding? Is that what we're looking at, sort of putting all these together? Now, in full disclosure, you talk about the East Coast Greenway, and I want to remind my listeners that I'm an advisory board member of the Greenway. So, and it's a really, really important north-south part of this Greenway system. So tell me, what are you thinking is going to happen with all these funding opportunities?
Sure. So I kind of came about the story because I know the cycling advocates and the Greenway advocates quite well in New York. I've, you know, been in touch with them, known their work for some time. I cycle on the Greenway all the time. And I have one, you know, maybe 10 minutes from where I'm sitting right now, and knew it as being, you know, great, practical, but very disconnected. You know, there's a bunch of little segments of greenways around New York City. And this group for a long time now, it's a coalition of groups, they're calling for a full 5-borough greenway. And that's how I first came on the story. Bloomberg wanted to make it a bit greater and make it kind of more national. And that's how I fell into the larger greenway stimulus push. But with this $10 billion, essentially you would connect them. You would make this kind of, you know, I think Dennis Mercado Soriano, the head of ECG, the East Coast Greenway, called it a trunk. This would provide the money for this kind of larger trunk around the country where cities and states can kind of build to it, right? We'd have this kind of federal backbone greenway, much like you see in Holland and some other countries where the cities are all connected. Cities, towns are all connected by a walking and cycling path. Right now we have all these mini really great projects, but there hasn't been this federal vision. And I would say there hasn't been a federal vision like this for transportation since the 50s with the Interstate Highway, which was kind of the point I was making this kind of analogous to that. Right now, we just have, you know, like you were saying, the Red Line Greenway where you're at. We have the New York City Greenway. And I think what was so important about the East Coast Greenway is that it's kind of done the work to connect all these. It's done the work to kind of look at all these projects and realize, you know, some are good. Others could use a bit more love. And then a bunch are just disconnected. I mean, only a third of the East Coast Greenway is actually off-road, which I think is really important to note. And that's taken 30 years just to make that happen. So this $10 billion, you know, I think, you know, Dennis lined out about $3 billion would just be for the East Coast Greenway. The New York City advocates have been calling for $1 billion just for New York City and New York State, even though there's been other greenways attached to it already. And then you would kind of sparse all this money up through greenway projects all over the country. And it would ideally be a kind of this larger, you know, system.
So this is a question that didn't come up for me till right now, and that is, who would manage not just the funding part, but the coordination of saying, well, this will connect here, this will connect there, and we suddenly are all connected. What kind of organization needs to be in place to do that kind of groundwork to get it really connected?
I think there's a couple different approaches that can be taken there. And this came up through the bills that are existing in Congress, which we could talk a bit about in a little bit, and also what some of the subjects told me. My mind immediately jumps to what Carter Strickland told me. And Carter is the New York State head of Trust for Public Land, which is a huge nationwide. They do land preservation. They do rails to trails all over the country. He had the idea that every single state DOT has a greenway division so they can coordinate with other state DOTs. And I thought that was a really interesting idea. And then on top of that, the more federal one we heard about, that's in the National Regional Greenways Act, which is making its way through Congress right now. You would have an office within DOT and a grant fund within DOT just for greenways. And what I found kind of through my reporting is that greenways get funded from all these different pots. There's like little funds here, but there isn't this kind of larger one just for kind of greenway coordination. So I think from having that funding mechanism would spring kind of a larger coordination, because right now it's remarkably divided. I mean, the one in New York that's been built has been congressional allocations, it's been city money, it's been state money. It's a complete piecemeal funding right now.
So let me reintroduce you. We'll take a real quick break and we'll come back to talk a little more about the Greenway, National Regional Greenway Act, and also some other ideas. We're speaking with John Sirico. He has written an article for Bloomberg's City Lab titled Greenways Stimulus Could Bring Boom in Bike and Walking Trails. And it is so true. We are on the cusp of something really great. So you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. We're speaking with John Sirico. He is a journalist. He has got an article in Bloomberg City Lab this past week titled Greenway Stimulus Could Bring Boom in Bike and Walking Trails. And what it's sort of an auspicious time given how big bicycling has been because of the pandemic. It has sort of changed the way people look at bicycles, at least some people, we hope. So I'm wondering a couple of things. We were talking about funding and how maybe we would put all this money into one pot and then somehow dip in. I know there's something called earmarks. They were for a while sort of banned and now they're creeping back in. And from what I understand, I was talking to the head of CalBike, Dave Snyder, and he said earmarks are really not a bad thing. And I think they have a bad connotation. What do you know about earmarks and whether that would be something that would work for greenways?
Yeah, so earmarks, you know, coming up as a kid in the Bush administration, earmarks had a terrible connotation during the Bush years, which is when they were last used. You know, there was a bunch of congressional, if you remember, there's all those corruption scandals, earmarks, you know, pork barrel spending, everything was being used for, you know, constituents, you know, Congress members were just pulling earmarks for personal pet projects, even though it wasn't really for the public. Then it got a really bad rap, but really, you know, some would argue it's true constituent services, right? It's Congress members bringing back money to their home district, which is constituent services at its core. So now they've come back in this House of Representatives, and they've changed their name. Now they're the community, their community requests, I believe, or community development requests, community projects requests. But they have much tighter restrictions. So you have to fill out all these criteria. They're trying to combat those kind of accusations of fraud. And these were, you know, early kind of days of greenway construction, these were huge. This was how the East Coast Greenway really got built out in those early days. Congress members, you know, advocates would stump Congress members would bring money home. So that was one of the main things right now that advocates say they're hopeful about this Congress, because earmarks are back and they can get hopefully some greenway dollars from there.
Interesting. And that's sort of what Dave Snyder said, that they're not a bad thing, that in fact, it is a way to bring a good project to your constituents, given your place in Congress. It's sort of what you should be doing, like taking care of the people at home. What a concept, yeah. Right? So I also would like to talk about where there will be real funding. So this $10 billion number is a potential. It's not a given. So how do you think it's going to come about? What is it going to take to actually A, get this infrastructure bill a little bit past the talking stage. And I know a new proposition came up from the Republicans again today, not meeting the criteria here.
Yeah, and this is really the story of what happens to greenways is really the story of where the Biden administration goes from here. It really is. I mean, like, as you saw, Shelley Caputo, the Republican negotiator, is saying they don't have another plan that kind of hit this kind of divide where they don't seem to be able to plug it up. And perhaps the Biden administration goes forward through reconciliation, which is how they passed the American Rescue Plan, or they keep trying to get the Republican votes. That remains to be seen, even though it seems like reconciliation is being talked about much more. The thing to keep in mind, I think what's really key here is this bill that's been kind of floating around Congress for 2 years now, which is the Service Transportation Reauthorization Bill. This bill, if you're a big federal policy wonk, this is the bill that literally funds the DOT. You know, this bill, it's a huge deal. It happens every 5 years. You know, this is what lobbyists kind of, you know, pour over Congress for to make sure they're getting transit dollars in there. The last one passed under Obama, the FAST Act, but that didn't get kind of extended. It has to get extended every 5 years, I believe. So it didn't get passed last year in the Republican held Senate, got extended by a year, and now it's up for a vote. And what's really important about this bill is that it really sets federal transportation policy. And I would say, and I think, Diane, we talked about this last time I came on the show, is that transportation policy in 2021 is looking very different than what it did in 2016 or 2017, the last time the bill was passed. You know, there's real talks here about electrifying the transit fleet. There's real talks here about, you know, getting rid of highways. There's real talks about, you know, cycling. And that's really important to be following kind of what happens with this bill. So one kind of possibility I see really unfolding is that all this greenway talk, you know, Democrats start to basically pick apart pieces and put them into these kind of smaller bills. And they pass it through the finish line that way. We're seeing this right now with Ed Markey's bill. It's a couple of different senators, but Ed Markey's the big name on it. He has this act called the CATS Act. It's all these different acronyms, Connecting America's Active Transportation Systems, which is basically a huge greenway bill. It would be for walking and cycling infrastructure, but it would be a big, I believe every single year it would be, it would be $500 million a year for grants for pedestrian cycling infrastructure, which would be huge for cities and states all over the country. That's being added to the service bill. So I see different pieces of the greenway getting across the finish line being plugged into different little bills. And perhaps that's a way forward, right? They're adding this huge omnibus, you know, the big spending American jobs plan that we've been hearing so much about.
Let's hope so. Once again, we're speaking with John Sirico. He is a journalist who covers urban planning and transportation. And his article in Bloomberg City Lab last week, Greenway Stimulus Could Bring Boom in Bike and Walking Trails, is what we're talking about, this greenway bill. So I guess I'm thinking about some of the states who don't have the stake in it that a New York does or a Los Angeles does or a Chicago, even in the South, Atlanta, maybe Dallas and Austin. What about states that don't have a lot of interest in, and I know that's kind of a bad way of looking at it maybe, but don't really have a lot of interest in greenway structures. So will that money be evenly divided? Is there a way that we can figure out who really needs what and who doesn't?
Yeah, you know, this is really interesting because it kind of gets into what's happened over the last couple of years. So when federal policy changed in the early 1990s, which essentially was the first time we allowed federal highway dollars to be spent on greenways, that's when we saw rail to trails really come about. That's when we saw kind of all these new connective transit talk come out when the first kind of ECG segments came about. It was a really big time in the early 90s when that, you know, this transport policy changed for the first time since Eisenhower, basically. Since then, what's basically happened is that, again, you have this fractured kind of vision where there's different federal pots and states and cities are kind of doing their own like little pieces here and there. And it's really landed on advocates like East Coast Greenway and others kind of connect the dots and make the case that these are really, really good economic packages for your city, right? I think this is something that East Coast Greenway Alliance has really focused on, you know, these case studies that show if you put in, you know, $8 million for this greenway, it'll lead to $30 million in economic output,
right?
You know, brings people to your region, all that. That's definitely part of the selling that I think needs to happen. but also what you've seen on the really local ground, because I think cities and states have really taken the ball and run with it. This has gone across political spectrums. So you have areas in conservative states that might not be as kind of keen to these greenways, but you see cities realizing it's a good investment. I'm thinking of Atlanta with the Beltline, you know, Georgia, I mean, up until recently, red state, Atlanta going through with the Beltline. Dallas has some interesting projects going on, some greenways there, but you might not see it at the Texas House, right? It's really the city that's doing it much more kind of ambitiously, you know, and you see this with, you know, Charleston has some greenways, trying to think of what else, Nashville has some greenways, red states, but blue cities that kind of are doing it. I think that once this kind of takes off and you see this kind of push, this sales pitch, that's basically like, this is a good economic investment. Dennis cited Jacksonville, Florida. You know, I think we'll start to really see it as this is an amenity you need to have. And maybe you kind of pair that with the COVID recovery, right? This is a great investment. It can bring money to your city. And then with the $10 billion being divided up, that would be kind of, it could be through grants. It could be through huge projects. That would be something that states would have to bid for it, essentially. They would have to bid for that this $10 billion pot. But that remains to be seen how that's going to get through. I think the Greenway stimulus organizers at this point are just trying to even get it in the American Jobs Plan, right, and even get it talked about, and then implementation. I mean, but so much of the American Jobs Plan, the next point is getting across the finish line, then figuring out how do we spend all this money.
So you make an interesting point about the economic development, and what a lot of people aren't talking about is the difference in building greenways as far as jobs go, building roads and bridges or repairing roads and bridges. So building greenways is a job-producing project.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was something that with the price tag, this came up where this huge Houston interstate that recently was halted, the Interstate 45,
right?
You know, which is, of course, it links jobs. Obviously, people use it. They're driving to their jobs. But that alone, that expansion was going to be $7 billion, which is about, you know, 7/10 of what this
right, exactly.
stimulus would be.
Three-quarters of it, practically.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one project in one city that, you know, if we kind of put those economic numbers towards greenways, which, you know, East Coast Greenway, they've got some good case studies out there to show this could really, you know, pay dividends. And they're really looking at states and cities that have not waited for Washington to get their act together, just doing it themselves, which I think is really, I mean, that's the story of transportation, you know, in America for the large part, that cities and states have really picked up where they felt like Washington has it.
So one other item about the money part, and that is $10 billion sounds like a lot of money, but when you look at the overall size of a transportation bill, it really is a rather small slice of what the administration's talking about.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the service transport, you know, let's call it the service bill, that alone is $303 billion. You know, that's, 30 times more than what we're asking for greenways, and that's for spending for DOT's policy. So it's not necessary. I want to say it's kind of a penny in comparison. It's a good price tag, of course, but you know, it's something that when you look at highway spending, when you look at what all federal transportation or the majority have gone to, especially for DOT, highways cost a ton of money, right? And we know now the kind of adverse effects. You know, we know about obviously environmental justice issues, which is what's halting that Houston project right now. We know that they require a ton of maintenance. We know that they have a lot of faulty infrastructure after a couple of years. We know all those things now. So I think this is really a lens of, okay, what else can we do with these dollars that we have? What else can we be spending on that actually could pay, you know, could lead to more job creation, could lead to better climate, could lead to, you know, great equity kind of advances. I think while you're seeing this Greenway kind of conversation come up, it's mirroring the larger conversation I think that's happening in transportation, which is highways no longer reign supreme, right? It's not, they're finally being questioned, I think, after 60 years as not the only answer for what we want transportation to look like in the country.
I totally agree. The last thing I want to talk about is the next generation of people who will be using transportation. And I think we're seeing more and more people opting out of owning a car, out of wanting to own a car, and out of wanting to make that investment in wasting time in a car. So I'm wondering how important will this newer generation's voting record be, and how we, even now, even if we're of an older generation, can get involved. I mean, I'm involved in the Greenway. I do all this PR and urban planning stuff, talking with people like you, talking with people like Dave Snyder. What can my listeners do, do you think, to encourage their legislators, from city on up, from, you know, their towns on up, to look at how important this Greenway idea is?
I think the point you made earlier about the bike boom, and I wanted to make that very clear early on in the story, that we're undergoing quite a significant surge in bike use, and it's still going. It hasn't stopped. You know, it's pretty remarkable to see some of these numbers, hearing the stories about how bike shops are still low on supply and how they predict it's going to stick around. And yeah, and it's something that I put early on because the Greenway numbers in New York are off the charts. And, you know, most recently, Street Films, Clarence Erickson did this video on Kenta Avenue in Williamsburg, part of the Greenway, and showed that there was more people on a bike than there were cars in the street next to it. And he used that as an argument to, you know, we should be expanding the Greenway. And I think for people that are listening, doing that kind of local work, because Greenways run through cities, it's not just this kind of ideally it would be in this interstate, you know, for organizers, it would be this interstate system. But so much of it is at the local level. So much of the fights happen at the local level. Doing that local kind of impact assessment, seeing Greenways in your neighborhood or where they could potentially be, you know, measuring, showing data. So much as there's such a lack of data, and so many times where, you know, at these Greenways where you could be counting cyclists, you could be counting how many people are there, you could be counting how many stores opened up along the Greenway, things that your city and state might not be doing, that you can have a lot of citizen-led data there that I think just helps make the case for. And then also saying to obviously your legislators that this is something you want, this is something that's great for the neighborhood, this is something that would bring jobs back. I think the jobs piece is really important right now, given the economic climate. Just kind of that local advocacy, because so much of this is going to run through cities. But I think right now, as we kind of see what goes on in Washington, a lot of the fight will have to be done through cities and states. It's not so much calling up your Congress member, which of course you could do as well. It's really figuring out how do I get best promote the Greenway in my own backyard, or advocate for more, you know, but you do that by getting that data, making that argument, hearing from people using the Greenway. I think that's so important. I think the best argument for the Greenway was that video that Clarence did, to be honest, because it really shows that there are thousands of people using this every morning now. I've been on that Greenway and I've been stuck in bike traffic now. That's a really powerful thing to show that there's more cyclists than cars on it. And now it's the same that we're seeing this, you know, if we think this bike surge is going to stick around for future generations, I mean, they're going to, you know, we have to have the infrastructure ready for them when they're ready to get on a bike, right? That's the kind of idea, that you would have this infrastructure that keeps this bike boom going. It sustains it. So this isn't just a flash in the pan like it was in the 1970s with the oil crisis. You know, that kind of, you know, simmered, but then kind of died out. This, obviously, with this infrastructure, and we've learned a lot since then, but with this infrastructure, it needs to obviously sustain it and show that this can be possible.
And I think it will. I really believe we have some momentum we've never had before. We've had interest we've never had before. And I think we have some good people working on it in a way, like a Dennis, like you, like Dave Snyder. Everybody wants to see safe and efficient infrastructure. Well, John, this has just been, of course, another great conversation. What are you working on next? I know you always have such interesting projects. What's next for you?
What am I working on next? So I'm writing another story for City Lab about the outdoor parklets and where they kind of go from here, the kind of COVID era parklets.
Nice.
I did something similar on that about open streets, slow streets, and kind of what the future of it is. This one's more focused on accessibility. You know, I've heard from a couple of accessibility advocates to make sure these parklets are accessible to everyone, no matter if they have a disability, no matter if their age.
Right.
So that's something I'm working on, which is a conversation I think is very important to have. And then other than that, kind of following what happens in Washington. That's where I'm getting a lot of my ideas right now, because that to me is really dictating even where the money's coming in kind of my own backyard. So following a lot what's going to happen in Washington, but I'll have some more stories definitely coming out soon.
Well, and we can follow John. So it's John Sirico, Surico. If you want to read this article, it is the May 4th edition of Bloomberg City Lab. And it's really an interesting online source. Does he do a publication too?
Yeah, Bloomberg City Lab is part of the larger Bloomberg company.
Bloomberg
so there's
News,
a bunch of different ones. I would also suggest Bloomberg Green, really good. Their climate vertical is great. They have a lot of intersections between City Lab and the Green, of course. So I would check out all of them. They're all good verticals.
And from what I can remember, Jeanette Sadiq Khan still works for Bloomberg.
Yeah, she works for Philanthropies. They're kind of the arm of Bloomberg, which helps city leaders kind of figure out new initiatives and kind of get kind of federal grants to rethink streets more for Sadiq Khan, for the work she does.
Well, John, thank you again so much for writing a great article, for taking time to talk with me today. And I know we'll talk again.
Yeah, thanks so much, Diane. I love coming on the show. Talk to you soon.
All righty. Take care. I really enjoyed talking with John. If you're interested in his article for Bloomberg City Lab, log on to OutspokenCyclist.com for this week's episode, number 559. I also like that he enjoys coming on the show and sharing his work with me. So my thanks to John and to David Bradford from Cycling Weekly. And thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next week, we'll be talking with People for Bike's Kyle Wagenschutz about their annual Bikeable City Survey and to the Trust for Public Lands New York director, Carter Strickland. It's going to be an interesting show. Please join our conversation on our Facebook page, follow us on Instagram, and feel free to comment on the show on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page. Or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.